Bonita, so good to see you. Welcome to Reggae World.
Thomas, thank you for having me. So nice to see you again.
Bonita, you are amongst, I'm sure, many other projects also in the midst of writing a book. And I have to say, the title intrigued me because it's at the same time very expressive, and at the other time, it's also kind of a riddle what you are pointing to. Your working title, I suppose. You called the book The Once and Future God.
I have to make a little correction that
Yes.
it's very important to me. A once in future God.
Okay.
Did you see how it opens it up a little?
Yeah.
A once in future God. Yeah, so that little difference is important to me. So it opens up the possibility of, to me, the what remains the same is once in futureness, but there can be different ways to disclose a once in future God versus I'm going to tell you what the once in future God is. So it's this, the properties of being once in future is the divine, and then there's different ways to populate or sing or model what that divinity would be. So I can only express a once in future God, and there could be different expressions of that. So I didn't want to pin it down to the once in future God. So it's a tiny little difference, but
But a big one at the same time, and seems to be also close to your heart, this difference and this opening.
yes. And the
And
funny thing is I've had this title as a mantra or a koan for over 12 years, and I always envisioned it as the last book I would write, and I had these other books in between. And as I got older, I got to realize, and I haven't ever written a full book, I got to realize that probably this is the only book I'll write. So I just picked this one back up, this title back up, and decided to concentrate on it. So the title itself has just been in my imagination and my curiosity for a long, long time. And now I just have to figure out what the title means. I have to unfold the title.
Oh, what was the thing that kind of kept this title alive? I mean, for this many years, there's something that must be alive in you that it's not one of the books, but it's your last book. So it's something, or at least it works as an idea as a last book.
Yeah. Well, I've considered myself a process philosopher. I've sometimes called myself an integral process philosopher. And for me, it's trying to wrap our heads around what our temporal frames of reference are. Like, how do we, when we talk about God, or we talk about an evolutionary spirituality, all these things have a certain assumption of how time happens. And I've read Whitehead over and over again and Hartshorne over and over again. And there's been a metaphysical puzzle in there that I've only started to solve recently. So it has to do with this notion of being inside a certain mental model of time, and it's there's reason to believe that that's not the temporal frame that, let's say, a notion of God would occupy. And so what has kept this project alive for me is that intuition that there's something completely new way we could construe the sacred and the divine in our world and our place in it, if we could have this shift in how we think of time as being linear or time as progressing in a certain way. And so that's pretty much why it's called a once in future God, and trying to reimagine God from, we look at a certain perspective and it's a past God, the creator. We look for another perspective and then we have the divine presence in our creaturely world. And then we look for another perspective and we see that from our perspective, the future is the future, it's unknown, it's something. But from God's perspective, if God has an if he can be aware of all of time, then what's future for us can be present for him. And what's creaturely for us will be past for him. And then once you start playing with these temporal frames, then it illuminates a lot of different questions that people have been asking in terms of spiritual models and religious models. So the turn there is really to play with the temporal aspect. There's always a temporal aspect as how we think of God. So in evolutionary spirituality, you know, it's not finished yet, and there's this momentum. So that's one temporal framework. In something like science, and we think of the origins as the Big Bang, and that's something that happened in the past. And I would argue that that's an incorrect. The Big Bang is not one and done, and you know, so that there's these different temporal orders you can play around with in asking these big questions. So that's, I think, the difference I'm trying to make, different contribution I'm trying to make.
It's interesting because just listening to you, my perception of the title changes. There was, and I wasn't so aware of it, but it makes sense now. Already this strange focus on time, the once and future, put as one, did something with my understanding of time that I could not locate. And it seems that this is not by chance. But the way you'd explain yourself, it more and more seems that the relationship to time is more the key than the
Yes.
understanding to the sacred, at least to open up of what you are focusing on.
Yes. It's trying to join the conversation with other people and say, but look, if we take this, you can call it a perspective, but it's really a very deep mental model, then a lot of what we're saying starts to look like this. And it's just another an unfoldment of the conversation around God. I can, you know, we can go into some easy examples of that shift. But the whole thing is to write a book that has chapters that deals with religious and spiritual questions that have been dealt with forever from this shift. And to add that to our resource of how we resource these meaning making and these understandings.
And please tell me more what this shift is about.
It entails a few shifts, so we'll start with some specifics so people can kind of get an idea. Okay. So one of the shifts is we tend to, all spiritual and even scientific mental models have something called stratified reality. So intuitive, we say matter, life, mind, humans, or et cetera, atoms, molecules, this. And I think there's something incomplete and potentially a massive error in that. And so there's something intuitively correct, and then there's something that I think is problematic. So if we look at that, what are some of the problematic ways we work with that stack? One is we think that matter evolved in the past, but it's still evolving. Okay, so that's a simple one. We think the animals are one and done, and we're evolving. Everything of evolutionary significance evolves on our part of the tree. And I'm saying, no, you have to stretch the whole temporal understanding of that stack out. Everything is still evolving. So that's one move. Another move is that we tend to say things like cells are made up of matter, and matter is made of energy. We use this construction. I am made of cells. And so that's how we also kind of work sloppily with the stack. And the correction there is, when you hear it, it's going to be obvious, but it took me a long time. Took me a long time to figure it out. So if I say pizza is made of dough, and then I say, well, what is dough made of? Well, dough is made of wheat, and wheat is made of, well, what's you're leaving a lot out. You're subtracting from what is actually the case, these just kind of simple categories. But if I say pizza is made with dough and with the person making the dough and with the oven, and pizza is also made with wheat, and wheat is made with the agricultural revolution, and the agricultural revolution is made with the evolution of his humans, you see that the stack actually, when we think in terms of, leaves most everything important out. And so part of this is I'm saying when we look into the past to see God as origin, the perspective we take to frame the inquiry as past subtracts almost everything that matters, all the interstitial contingent events. And so we just see stars, galaxies, this, that, and Big Bang. Or we just see, Gurdjieff's first, third, ninth worlds. Our models become have the same problem with this stacking when we think of them in terms of, when we think of them as composing the next higher level in terms of. And what I want to talk about is the with that. So, we are made with God, and God is made with our evolutionary history because we reimagine that God, that Godness, the revelation unfolds as we evolve. So you get into this interentanglement that is based on temporal frame shifts. So I don't know if you can sense into that. It's a challenge to work it in the book, but I do use these examples like pizzas made with and stuff like that to give people a sense of to work people's minds into this new sensibility.
No, it's fascinating. The word that you just used, entanglement, seems to be very appropriate, the way I hear you. And when you are describing your examples are in this stack model, the linearity, is obvious and kind of foregrounded, that everything is kind of built on something else and something else, and you see this linear model of something versus, and that I found it quite irritating because I didn't know what to make out of it. The way you spoke about time is like time becoming transparent,
Yes.
and I don't know what that means.
Well, that's a word Gebser used, and we don't really know what it means. You can read him over and over. And it's very hard to understand what he means, but this could be some kind of shift that he intuited or envisioned. Time becomes transparent to us because we can maneuver with it as a part of the perspective, just like our perspectives have become transparent to us. Once you become aware of taking perspectives, then you can become aware of taking time. It starts with Einstein when he realizes that there is no privileged time-space relationship, and then in a scientific sense. So one of the things in the book is it's very important to me to be able to tag back into some of the new sciences which are working with some of these insights also. So I think that one could say that both in the sciences and in spirituality, the time is becoming transparent. It's becoming operable, in thought.
As you mentioned, Jean Gebser, and also because your work is related to integral thinking, there is this kind of strange thing with Gebser that he is kind of seen by many as one of the fathers of this integral thinking and evolutionary thinking. And one of the things he most tried to get away from is the word evolutionary. And there's a whole drama around it. Basically, what people try to do with him and what he seemed to kind of try to get away from. And it seems to be kind of related to what you're talking about here.
So he doesn't want you to think evolutionary means progressive, like the stack. And then he has these epochs, or epochs of conscious structures. And he says that they become deficient in time, and hence they have to change. But they don't change in so the way I talk about it is most people use the word evolutionary and they're thinking development. So in development, the next higher level has to build on the previous higher level. I have to be 2 feet tall before I'm 3 feet tall. I have to be able to do abstractions in order to think in terms of systems of abstractions. So in this sense, the stage-like character of development is quite trivial, right? Like, do you see what I'm saying? It's like, all right, so Darwin's evolution, the word evolution was never supposed to mean that, because that's not how evolution works. And this is also what Gebser is saying. That's not how evolution works. And if you look at the evolution of species, after extinction events, it's usually a lower prior form that then is the ancestor of the next highest species. So evolution has this kind of, it keeps everything in play for longer periods of time. In my spirituality, I say if I look at a frog, I see both my ancestor and the potential progenitor of the next highest form. Because it's just science. The word in just scientific evolution, that's exactly how it works. So again, now this problematizes the stack again, right? Because it's not just like amphibians in the past, and then it's like the whole organism of the earth is evolving. And to me, that's the first chapter of the book is called The Planetary God. And that is that, in a sense, even God is born on the earth, from the earth. Because God is made with the evolutionary history of humans and human consciousness. And so this is the creaturely God, the planetary God, not the once God. The once God made everything. But the creaturely God, the planetary God, is made with humans. Because this notion of divinity is disclosed through humanness. So it's embedded within the evolution of humans. So there's just these different shifts that disclose the sense of the sacred. So now the sense of the sacred, the frog is all of a sudden becomes sacred in a different way. It's not sacred just because it's my ancestor. It's sacred because under some climatic conditions, they may be the highest form that lives and then goes on to found eventually in billions of years, something smarter than humans, something that reveals even more of reality and God. So that's the sense of it. Yeah, I've been reading a lot of books, and I read a book, The Ends of the World, which is about the five extinction events. I mean, this is another thing that spirituality has to come to terms with, that every, 250 or 300 million years, 97% of all species go extinct. And this has happened five times. And it's going to happen again in because we're going to enter in another inter we're going to come out of we're going to enter another ice age. And so he talks about the earth has these natural killing mechanisms. How do we reconcile that with the nation na nature the notion of the divine? That so these are interesting questions that are not I don't see them being written about.
I have to say, I'm trying to understand. And something that stuck with me is this difference between the Creator God and you called him the Earthly God.
Yeah, the planetary God.
And how you kind of related it also in your relationship to a frog. And how every species is kind of a holder of its own perfection in some way. And what I see is that the notion of God that you're working with, which I also translate as the sacred and the origin, is not just coming from the sky and doing things, but it's unfolding in the process of life that is unfolding here on Earth. And this seems to be important for you. If that is so, why?
Okay. So we have to go back to the stack. And this is a lot of this comes from process philosophy, especially Charles Hartshorne. So I'll try to make it understandable in conversation. So I'm made with cells. So my cells, the term that people often use, I am realized by my cells. cells, cell. So I'm a compound individual somehow. This is the mystery that people talk about a lot in process philosophy. And then there's the question of whether people, individual human beings who are compositionally realized by these members, can get together and become a higher organism. Can a collective of people create a subordinate, a superordinate consciousness, the way the collections of cells creates my consciousness? This is an interesting question. It's in our space. And so what I say is, because I do believe we are realized compositionally by these members of my body who have their own local consciousness, let's say, then I do have to agree that it's possible for that for humans to be members of a larger body with a unique consciousness. But I hope I argue, and I hope I prove in my book that that can only happen at the next higher level, which is the Earth, and that consciousness would be composed by all the members of the Earth, not just humans. So then that becomes the only, for me, the only next possible higher agency. And then, of course, we could imagine that the Earth also is a member of a galaxy. I don't go into that because then it becomes so speculative. But I do bring up the question of if we're searching for this larger compound individual, that the only true candidate for that is at the level of the Earth. One of the easy ways to understand that is, when I get up and walk across the room, my cells enjoy that with me. They have no choice. But people can get up. They don't share the same inertial space-time frame of reference. But as the Earth flies around through space, we fly around with it. We have no choice but to fly around with it. Even when we go to the moon, we still have the inertial framework of the Earth. So that's part of what I'm arguing in the chapter on the planetary guard, is that this is our local unit of higher consciousness, the Earth as a whole. And for me, that makes sense. It's a speculation. It makes sense. But for me, that's important because I think we need a religion that is where the human is decentered and really feels, it's beautiful that we have this planet Earth and we think it's beautiful and then we pray to God. But I think what we need to do is we need to find this middle instantiation of God, and not bypass the Earth. I mean, we have like a lot of religions that think of now that humans are on the Earth, then everything of interest is going to happen on our branch of the tree. And I'm saying that that's metaphysically incorrect, and it's not the kind of religious message we need today.
You seem to make a couple of moves at the same time that I find very interesting. One is the claim of the possibility that we become cells of a collective consciousness, which is already kind of for our hyper-individualistic culture a very decentering
Yes.
the demand. And then you do two things at the same time, which is an expansion and a restraint. You expand it to what the ecology calls the more than human, world, and you hold it to the concreteness of Earth. So all of a sudden, we and in our postmodern time and consciousness, we still hold us mostly as individuated consciousness holders who are basically are located in our individuality. And even if we relate to the cosmos, we relate from this starting point. But you seem to first break that open, that we come together in something where we at least are not only individuals. And then you connect it with I call it the locality of Earth, as our real living space that is, as you said, circling around the galaxy, or at least the sun system. And at the same time, also opening up that we are not only connected to each other, we are also connected to everyone and everything else. And this seems to be related to your understanding of the sacred of God somehow.
Yes. Yeah, should be. So I think that, so that's the creaturely God, the planetary God. Then there's a chapter on the cosmogenic God, which is the creator God. That puts that in context. And then there's the future God. So the book follows, well, the book actually starts with the planetary God and then goes back. You see, back in time is not the correct expression, to the creator God. But you know, now you can also already hear, like, saying back to the creator God is part of this temporal constraint. And then it ends with the future God. So the planetary God is looking at God from the what in God's long arc of consciousness would be the present impression, or the primary impression, as William James would say. So when we look at cosmology, we are looking retrospectively, right? So we look into the past and we see light that is coming from galaxies that may no longer exist, right? So we're looking into the past. This is very interesting in terms of cosmology. What does it mean to see things from the past? Because it takes light that long to get here. And I'm saying we need to ask ourselves that same question when we think about God as creator. We're in this retrospective framework, and that has implications for how we can understand the past. And so, for example, one of the things that happens when we're in this retrospective framework is that we need a lot more interpretive lenses to figure out what's going on or to understand what's going on. Oh, I can give an easy example. So here's an easier example. David Graeber says that anthropology is weird because you study only things that last, like stone monuments and bones, and he says, he does make the statement that traditionally that's been the work of men. And you don't find, when you look into the past of our human history, you don't find the things that don't survive. You don't find things like how women raised their children, and what kind of different languages came and went, and how what touch was like, and You can't reconstruct those things, and yet that's all the with. Human history is made with all those things we can't reconstruct. And it's the same with cosmology. We look into the past, and I use the term, things are subtracted. So all the interstitial things that didn't survive, but what is contingent on, we can't get to them. And I'm saying when we look, do the same thing with spirituality, we have to be aware that we have a lens of retrospection on, and that's the once God. That's what's revealed through that lens is the once God. And what's revealed through the lens of being here on earth is the creaturely God or the present God. And then if you can figure out those, if you subtract things by looking in the past, then what does it mean to take a future lens and then have a future God? And so it's all this way of understanding that these three modes of inquiry come with different temporal frames, and they actually create different lenses of how and what we can know. And so then you basically have, I mean, you could even map it onto the Trinity if you wanted to make a case for the triune God, like Panikkar does. But it's always in this temporal shifting that's happening. So in the Trinity, the God, the triune God is God the Father is the creator. That's one lens. The Holy Spirit is the future God, and the creaturely God is Christ, right? So Christ is here on earth in creaturely form. And I'm saying that it's a temporal frame shift, those three aspects. I'm sorry, I'm not doing a good job explaining it.
No, but you go to very refined territory here, and to the degree I can fo follow you, the created God or the earthly God seem to be somehow the starting point at where this is revealing itself. My guess is because we are contemplating it.
Exactly. That's beautiful, Thomas, because now it makes a difference. So in another part, I talk about what, like, I'll just use this one. So what you just said is a cognate event that grows, but it grows into the past, because now that you understood that and you look into the past, it will change what you are reconstructing, and it will change the future. So every agent is a resonant that grows. And if you're a cognitive agent, you're a cognitive event that grows. And so our starting point is the earth for now. Maybe we become, I don't know, but I think you're absolutely right. It's we even the great evolutionary theists like Teilhard de Chardin and well, Sri Aurobindo, I don't think you'd call him a theist, but they don't totally start from the planetary God. And this is very similar to Latour's last book, which is kind of hard to read about. Earth something. But this I would say is an epistemic constraint that we're born in the middle. And then I say, and because of that, actually so is God. He's born, and this is tricky because I'm not saying it's just a construct. we have experiences and revelations of some deeper reality. We can call that God. So I'm not saying it's just a construct, but in a sense, yeah, in a sense, we're born in the middle and God's born in the middle, which is the definition of Christ, I think, basically.
And it doesn't have to mean that he is a construct when you say that it's or his opening starts in the middle.
Exactly.
And it seems that this is at least one of the main points that seems to be very important for you, to not miss the starting point
Right.
where everything unfolds from. And unfolds to the past and to the future, and to make it more complex than also the past and the future unfolds back to the middle. There is also a reinforming from what is opening up, and there's an interplay between the past
Right.
and the present and the future, and. You seem to focus to really allow this contemplation in its presence.
Yes, that's beautiful. And now we'll make the meta. So that is the primary message. That's where we start from. And now we make the metaphysical shift. Okay. And we say maybe God's experience is the same, except so in one sense, from our perspective, we're born here in the middle and God is born on the earth also. Now we're going to go and we're going to do some speculative metaphysics and say, but from God's perspective, maybe he's just something that's unfolding in from into the past and future also. But we don't know what the center is from God. It's the center that's the center of everything, right? And so well, that's what I'm saying. So in essence, what you just said about our local experience here on Earth is the radiance of God setting out this very, very large temporal order. And this is obviously speculative now versus what we first said. I actually experienced this on Earth. And then I speculate, well, at the largest level of consciousness, maybe that's also the template. Maybe it's like that locally because that's how it is universally, how it is for God.
Which, of course, is a speculation.
Yes.
But to some degree, it's also a contemplation.
Yes. Yes.
Because the way I hear you, God is also unfolding in our contemplating Him. And
Yes.
in that, He or she or it is revealing itself.
Right.
In it, so you have to, so you have the you have this centeredness that is earthly centered, but it's only earthly centered because basically that's where we start to contemplate.
Right.
How this unfolds, it's up to itself.
It's up to itself. Exactly. Yeah, so I think that's the basic felt sense or inspiration in the title and in the challenge of writing it.
What? Why is this something that is important to at least ponder on?
Well, for me, it's the personal answer is because, I spend a lot of time contemplating in nature and about nature. And I feel that So I'm basically a Taoist that way. I mean, I'm very close to nature and I've seen more remarkable things happen in nature. I think that the earth and the planet and what's happening on the planet is in jeopardy. And I think we have spiritually bypassed nature. And hence our environment is at risk. And so I have that kind of Taoist embeddedness in nature. But I called myself the other day a Taoist of Christian faith. But I also really, really love nature, and I feel loved by nature and the individual creatures and the potential and the possibility and the gift of nature is so deep within me that from a Taoist perspective, this is way out of balance. You know, from a Taoist perspective, you would never love nature and really care about it. It's much more outrageous, like Christian love or something. So when I combine those two, I get this sense of being a Taoist with Christian faith, because this outrageousness of pouring oneself into it or becoming completely intimate or you know, really having the sense that when I stand before the tree ingresses into me and changes me. So I breathe in its oxygen, it's breathing in its carbon dioxide. When I talk to you, you're ingressing into me. This constant exchange, this is all very alive to me in the way that the kind of Axial Age religion stories are not. I think I just think they bypass the earth. And for me, everything comes from and goes back into the earth at this local level. And then you can start speculating about it. But I think there's a real correlation or cause between the kind of religion we have and the kinds of effects or influences we have on the living environment. And I think it's not good enough to be a good Christian and have the virtue of caring for the earth as if it's down there and, you know, we're patronizing, we have to take care of the earth and take care of the animals. I think there's a deeper revelation, and that is that we are the earth, and so are all the other members. And there is a mysterious, sacred reality to this earth that we should be asking about, and not just looking at it as a jumping off place to continue our anthropocentric pursuits on other planets. I don't think that's realistic.
Bonita, we are in the middle of our conversation and the end of our time. But that is also representing something that's just very true to the whole unfolding, because you're in the middle of this book process. And we
Yes.
said before that we also will do another Radio Evolve webcast or when the book is done,
Yes.
also to see where all this that you are sharing with us right now is going to. I'm very grateful that you were willing to just share this, and I'm very much looking forward to your
Yes.
book.
I'm so appreciative of the platform, and I hope it's an enjoyable conversation for your audience. I know when you're writing at the edge of your thinking, it can be quite a little messy still.
Yeah, but there's also beauty in messiness sometimes.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.